Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says an increasing number of former leaders have demonstrated that they both seek and possess extended diplomatic afterlives. We look at people like Jimmy Carter, of course, and Bill Clinton, also Nelson Mandela, Tony Blair, Mikhail Gorbachev. These highly empowered individuals increasingly work to make a difference on the global stage by capitalizing on their celebrity status and their many, many connections. They've been working on a number of issues: poverty alleviation, voting, health and disease control, crisis prevention. And much of their work involved has shifted beyond the recognized power centers. So it's a whole new way of getting things done. And sometimes there are some problems. The Fuhrer, our guest, writes over whether the Clinton Foundation has been sufficiently transparent in revealing its donors, as Hillary Clinton campaigns for the presidency has thrown a spotlight on the charitable endeavors of political heavyweights. So we'll talk about that aspect of this issue as well. Joining us this hour to talk about all of it is the author of Diplomatic Afterlives. Andrew Cooper is our guest. He's a professor of political science at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and an associate senior fellow at the Center for Global Cooperation Research. He teaches in the areas of theory and practice of diplomacy, national perspectives on global governance, international political economy, and comparative and Canadian foreign policy. He has his PhD in philosophy from Oxford University. Welcoming phone calls as we look at the work of these leaders, 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Andrew Cooper, thank you very much for being with us, sir.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen. Good to be on. I think it's a fascinating topic. Hopefully your listeners will agree with that.
I think they will, too, and partially because these people who are involved in it are pretty fascinating people, aren't they? They're celebrities in their own right.
Exactly, and in many ways, that's why I wanted to do the book, because they have a sense of spectacle about them, but of course there's also this sort of hidden side, this more murky side.
Yes.
And it's, I think the two go very interestingly together.
The one who really seems to come to mind right away, and you write about him extensively in your book, is Jimmy Carter, who you say can be credited with providing really a prototype of this approach to the afterlife of a political career.
Exactly. And I mean, in many ways, it shows that you do have this afterlife. I mean, Jimmy Carter, one-term president, seen, of course, having some success in foreign policy, the Camp David Agreement and so on. But in other ways, of course, an incomplete reputation as a president. So he has this long afterlife that he gets into all sorts of activities that was probably up to that time we wouldn't have expected a former president to engage in.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the fact that during the Reagan years, Reagan kind of kept him at distance in terms of support for any type of initiatives that Carter was doing. But with the election of George Herbert Walker Bush, things changed. What happened?
I think he just, there was more flexibility, room, space, less sort of polarized ideological considerations. Jimmy Carter, of course, was much more in favor of global human rights, denuclearization, a lot of issues that, of course, Ronald Reagan was the complete opposite of. So with H.W. Bush, we can see the sort of space for Jimmy Carter to get in, I guess, what you'd call the mediation business, the election monitoring business, mm-hmm. and he sort of goes from sort of issue case to issue case, and it's a long record, not completely successful, but still a long record of a lot of achievement.
And going to places, as you remind us, in the world that nobody else would go.
Even to places that he'd had sort of problems in terms of reputation. Panama, for instance, associated with giving back, of the canal. The Republicans certainly saw him as a weak president because of that, and yet he engages Panama, he engages the electoral process. He engages with sort of democratic progress in Panama.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think this is very much part of his sort of, you know, image rebranding, is that he can go to difficult places, as you suggest, Peru, Venezuela, Eritrea, Ethiopia, all sorts of different places.
Do you know if there were powers that be, I don't know, in the United Nations or other world leaders or former presidents or people in politics who said to him and subsequently have said to others, this is not really any of your business. You're taking on issues that perhaps we should be taking on. We don't like your stepping on our territory.
I think probably that's very much the case. I mean, even though, of course, he's seen as a liberal president, he's still seen as an American president. And of course, there's questions of sovereignty, and you get into this. Peru, for instance, he's trying to essentially eject a sitting president in Peru through sort of democratic means by electoral observation, and
mm-hmm.
and the Peruvian regime is sort of saying, butt out. This isn't your business. This is sort of imperialism by other sort of means in that regard. But I think what he does is show that through sort of fairly technical aspects of policy, you can go to some forms of democratic change and, procedural flexibility.
We'll come back to Carter in a moment, but let's go to Bill Clinton, a very large figure on the world stage. And, of course, now we're looking at whether or not he's doing this work for his own benefit, for his wife's political career. There are many more questions about what he's doing. Few would say that what he's doing is bad. He's done a lot of good in the world. But he's also making, $200,000 a shot for a speech.
Exactly. And I mean, there's huge differences. I mean, even though I think Bill Clinton watches and learns from Jimmy Carter, I think without Jimmy Carter, I don't think Bill Clinton would be doing a lot of the good work. But he's a different politician. Certainly, he's more of a celebrity. Jimmy Carter does sort of engage in some celebrity work. He does Habitat with Brad Pitt and so on. But you wouldn't say that he's sort of a Hollywood type. Bill Clinton is, and he sort of hangs out with a whole different network of people, not just entertainers, but people in the high-tech world, even people in the Wall Street world. So this, of course, gives him a lot of advantages because he can lever all of those network connections to do good work, but it also gives this sort of image that, as I said before, that there's a certain murky side. Particularly, of course, as he builds up his own portfolio of doing speeches and, performing, in a sense, before not only domestic audiences, but around the world as well.
Has he been, would you say, sufficiently transparent in revealing his donors?
I think there wouldn't be such a big media outcry about this issue if he was totally transparent. I mean, I think there's a lot of like I say, good work, but I think the real problem is that there's really a hard process to try to figure out what is what. What is he raising money for his own, sort of personal benefit? What is raising money for his foundation? What is he raising money for, of course, Hillary Clinton's campaign for presidents? So all of these, it's a very complex circumstances, and I think the more money he makes, of course, the more the issue becomes an important, significant one.
Mm-hmm. And what about the areas that Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and others in the world have chosen to operate? Do they pick those countries, those parts of the world in which they have been most welcomed?
In some ways, it's more the question of issues where they have a lot of focus on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with probably one commonality, of course, is that they both did some sort of diplomatic work after they left the presidency on North Korea. you know, in very different circumstances. Jimmy Carter was more to see if there was an opening for the North Koreans in terms of their nuclear weaponry. Bill Clinton, it was more sort of a quick dash of diplomacy. If you remember 2009, two female journalists were picked up and jailed in North Korea when they were working for Al Gore's television station, and Bill Clinton goes in a sense rescues them, and you know, with a great deal of publicity coming back in a plane with advisors and so on. So that's the similarity. The difference is that I think there's really a contrast, not only in focusing where their strengths are. I mean, Jimmy Carter sees his strength as mediation. He sees the greatest strength from his presidency, the Camp David Agreement on the Middle East. So he does have a great deal of attention on the Middle East. But there's also focusing on weaknesses as well. And I think you see that with Bill Clinton. He sort of, and you've got to give him a lot of credit for this. He kind of goes back to places where not the big victories of his presidency, but in some ways the failures. He goes back to Rwanda, the failure of stopping the genocide in 1994. He goes back to Africa and dealing with HIV/AIDS, and this is sort of teaming up with Nelson Mandela, Bill Gates, and others, where certainly on public health, I think he sees his presidency as not achieving the results. So it's an interesting question in this regard. And, of course, we've seen him in the last week or so going to Bosnia, where obviously another perceived failure in terms of mediation, in terms of crisis management took place during his presidency. So once more, I think we have to sort of give him credit. He doesn't avoid where he's made mistakes or has gaps or, you know, hasn't sort of filled sort of a purpose. He goes back and sort of in some ways tries to compensate for those failures.
Let's go to Tony Blair for just a moment to get away from American presidents. You talk about in March, the Save the Children Foundation apologized to those that it had upset by a decision by the U.S. branch of Save the Children to give Tony Blair a Global Legacy Award last year for his work on Africa. So sometimes doing good can land you in deep water because of politics.
And a huge divide. I mean, in many places in the world, Tony Blair is still seen as not only a hugely successful British prime minister, he had three electoral victories with the Labour Party, but also, of course, somebody that did the right thing on many issues, intervention on Sierra Leone, intervention on Kosovo. But of course, the big question in Tony Blair, and this is why he's still so unpopular, even with his own party in the United Kingdom, of course, is the support for the Iraq War in 2003. So there's this huge kind of divide that he can go off, he can make a lot of money. He's probably the only other former leader that makes similar amounts of money than Bill Clinton. But at the same time, it's difficult for him to even sort of, in some cases, go out in public in Britain because of the unpopularity that he has.
Hmm. What about Nelson Mandela? When did he formulate what he was going to do? And I'm familiar with the work he did, certainly with HIV/AIDS and with tuberculosis. But there's a man who lived a long, long time and did a lot, considering the number of years he spent in prison.
Oh, an amazing man. And of course, a man that many people wanted him to go into a peaceful retirement. He'd done enough.
Right.
He'd been, an amazing leader, but also an amazing African leader in the sense of leaving office after one term, which is, of course, not the usual way, of course, in some African countries. So the fact that he leaves and then, of course, has this second life, where he engages, like Bill Clinton, in many issues where he either sees himself as being a failure or the ANC, the African National Congress, as being a failure. And as you suggest, on on HIV/AIDS, I think, is the particular. And he devotes a huge amount of attention to try to sort of rectify the situation. It's interesting, his first major trip after he leaves office is to Seattle to engage with the Gates Foundation, to engage with what, you know, they're doing in terms of health policy. And, of course, to try to tap into the resources of the Gates Foundation and other foundations in the United States.
And he did tap into the Gates Foundation in a big way, didn't he?
Very much so. And in this regard, you can see sort of the pattern of networks, because the Gates Foundation kind of fuels a lot of the work of the former leaders. The Gates mm-hmm. Foundation gives money to the Carter Center in Atlanta. They give money to the Clinton Global Initiative. But, of course, they also give a lot of money to the front line in South Africa and Africa generally. And there, I think you really see sort of this sort of mixture of I guess, sort of first world and the global south in a very dramatic way. I mean, nobody can sort of draw a crowd and bring sort of corporate attention to an issue like Nelson Mandela, and he was very good on, it seems, on the phone. He could sort of persuade people to do things. You didn't have to phone up twice, I think, or you know, if Nelson called,
right.
you'd say yes, you know, I'll do that.
I bet you will. This is who calling?
Yes,
Nelson
exactly.
Mandela. Yes, sir.
Exactly.
What can I do for you?
and the same on education. I mean, you know, even though I think he could be proud of a lot of things the government did in 4 years as president, given the situation in South Africa, the huge gaps in terms of education. So you can see Nelson Mandela also sort of trying to do work on those issues as well. Where it's much more problematic for him is sort of the work that Jimmy Carter does, you know, in terms of mediation. He sort of picks some issues that are very difficult, some African issues on Burundi, which are still sort of, you know, huge ethnic strains. And, of course, he ventures into the Middle East and, you know, never an easy
right.
sort of area to try to be a mediator in.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Andrew Cooper is our guest this hour. His book is Diplomatic Afterlives, and he is a professor of political science at the University of Waterloo in Canada. He has been studying particularly the ones that we know the most about, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Nelson Mandela, Tony Blair, Mikhail Gorbachev, who after their time in leadership of their states went on to forge these global initiatives, to work with foundations in order to further their humanitarian efforts on a wide range of issues. But some of the problems we mentioned with the Clintons, in that Bill Clinton also could benefit, certainly, in terms of large speaking fees from some of the work that he was doing. And there have been some problems with some of the money coming into campaign coffers, perhaps as a result of his relationship that has been forged because he's doing this international work. So, what do you think? And it, of course, brings up the question that some of these people may have been much better out of office doing the work they're doing than they did than they were thought of when they were in office. Jimmy Carter comes to mind immediately. So many have said that he's been an incredible, hard-working, going to dangerous places, and not trying to toot his own horn that much, much better after president than president. What do you think? Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. We'll also look at President Barack Obama, who will be leaving office in January of 2017. Will he be expected to enter the world stage in some way as well? Should he? Is it a good thing? What do you think? We'll be with you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We're talking this hour about diplomatic afterlives with Andrew Cooper, and we start our calls with Gary in Madison. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I don't mean to belittle what Jimmy Carter has done, but my goodness, it pales in comparison to what the Clinton Foundation has done in Africa. You have any idea how he stamped out AIDS? He and the guy who invented Microsoft have done is amazing. Not only AIDS, but Ebola. And if he gets a speaking fee, my goodness, joy be with him. He and his wife both have devoted their lives, for heaven's sakes, to public service. How in the world anybody can criticize the Clintons based on what they've done since they've been in office is beyond me. I think Jimmy Carter is fine. He didn't do much as a president. We had 20% interest rates, and we had the best economy in the world with Clinton. But Jimmy Carter has done fine things, but to cure disease is something else again. Those millions went to wonderful work. I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Professor Cooper.
No, I think it's good that there are those sort of positive views of Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, and certainly I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, there is this sort of other side, as we talked, the lack of transparency. I think the difference, though, is that the Clinton Foundation does focus on these, I guess what academics call public goods issues, you know, on health issues, on education, and therefore they get really good aspects of deliverables. You can kind of see what's happening. And of course, they're working with fantastic partners, with the Gates Foundation, even with, sort of NGOs on the ground in Africa and so on. I think the difficulty for Jimmy Carter is that he spread his sort of afterlife much more widely. Mm-hmm. So he's done quite a lot of work. The Carter Center does work on health issues. They get the same same support from the Gates Foundation. But what the Jimmy Carter and the Carter Center has done, of course, is to get into these more classic diplomatic roles in terms of election monitoring, mediation. And, of course, some of these don't give him the best press, going in and trying to monitor Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, trying to see if there can be sort of a reconciliation between Chavez and the opposition in Venezuela, is not the easiest task in the world. Bill Clinton has sort of avoided those things. He's gone in, I think, with fairly instrumental purpose. And, of course, because of that, well-deserved, gets good credit.
Mm-hmm. What about the work? How effective is it, and how did it come about when we have tsunami relief efforts that were led by Clinton and Bush?
I think that's interesting. And again, it goes back to your point about President H.W. Bush in terms of Jimmy Carter. There's been this sort of relaxation of the polarization, the ideological polarization, the fact that that Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush could work together on the tsunami and sort of even appear on the Super Bowl, you know, to kind of try to raise funds for the tsunami, I think shows a comfort level that those two have. It's certain generational, but I think it's also the fact that, of course, George H.W. Bush had a lot of international experience as well. He'd been ambassador in China. He'd done all sorts of different things. So, and, of course, he'd also worked for major, hedge funds and so on, Carlyle Asia and so on. So he kind of knows the world. He's comfortable in terms of taking on responsibility on particular issues.
Let's go next to Chuck in Northwest Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is that we all need to be very careful to not mix up the various Clinton fundraising efforts from political to private speech making, which how much he makes in total is none of our business, to his foundation, which does a great work.
Can you separate those two, Andrew?
Yeah, I think in terms of the media criticism, obviously they're looking for sort of irregularities, but I think it does go beyond that. It raises some serious questions. I mean, obviously, if there's money swirling around, people are looking to see whether this influences behavior. I certainly can't find any sort of hot button issue that you would have thought because the foundation, Clinton's foundation, got money that somehow Hillary Clinton was influenced in terms of policy. In fact, quite the opposite. We see some cases where Hillary Clinton is in part of a government where docks perhaps could be sold off in the United States, and the Dubai Port Authority is coming in as one of the bidders, but loses out in terms of that bidding process. So again, there doesn't seem to be any sort of hot button issue in this regard. Where the problem is more difficult to ascertain is when Clinton gets on planes with other people and, of course, travels to various parts of the world, because, of course, it's very easy for foreigners to kind of mistake Clinton as an ex-president with sort of having some sort of influence in terms of Washington right now. So, again, I think probably that's more the difficulty, is particularly where you see, again, money sort of coming in as both foundation money and money for speeches.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a lot of money on speeches. I mean, even the first year
yes.
he left office, he was making about $10
million. Whoa.
A year. And, of course, he gets a lot per speech. I mean, up to, just looking at the 2014 figures, I mean, he gets speeches mostly outside of the United States up to about $750,000 per speech.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is a lot of money, to have. And again, this is sort of, it does raise some sort of issues for many people, not just Republicans, but also some Democrats as well.
Yes. And you do write about, tell me if this was just an isolated incident and things changed in his life as a result of this. You write about Jimmy Carter not being completely free from images of commercial contamination, his early 90s link with the Bank of Credit and Commerce International.
Yeah, that actually collapses amidst the scandal. It's a Middle East bank, but it has connections in Africa, connections in Italy. And Jimmy Carter, I think unbeknownst to him, not only kind of uses some of the infrastructure of the bank, the planes and so on, but also takes money. But at the same time, I'm sure when Jimmy Carter is looking at the opportunity, he thinks that this is a sort of a generous donor, this is somebody who's benevolent and wants the best in terms of public goods. And again, this is probably what comes out in all of the episodes of former leaders, that there's always some sort of issue that comes out and bites them. Even Nelson Mandela has a few sort of episodes. He's sort of linked in with this very bizarre sort of case where Naomi Campbell, the model, gets sort of these blood diamonds from an African dictator, Charles Taylor.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, Nelson Mandela isn't implicated directly, but it's at a reception and an event that Nelson Mandela is hosting. So again, this is the real world. It's very difficult to have such a long record and not have some sort of glitches, not have some sort of embarrassments along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, even with Bill Clinton story. I mean, again, just because there is some murkiness and some lack of transparency, this certainly doesn't override the good work. And in many ways, I make the point in the book that the Clinton Foundation goes well beyond, I guess, what people in previous generations called the dash for cash. I mean, all you did as a former leader, or at least some former leaders, was to try to make money. And this is not the case with Bill Clinton. I mean, it's far more complex, far more sophisticated than that.
Thanks, Chuck. Mary in Madison. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick comment and a question. In wishing to bring to this discussion a bit of Central European history and Central European leaders, I'm wondering if the guest mentioned anything in his book about Václav Havel, who was a so-called dissident and playwright in communist Czechoslovakia, and then became the first president of the Czech Republic, and was very involved in not only human rights during his presidency, but afterwards with his civic forum, as well as his Izay Foundation. And he, too, experienced a lot of animosity in his own country after his terms, because people were very uncomfortable with some of his messages about human rights and facing and fighting aspects of totalitarianism, and then the aftermath of trying to bring people to justice. So I'm just wanting to incorporate that region of the world into the discussion and see what kind of comments your guests have.
Great, thanks. I'm glad you did, Mary. Thank you.
No, this is a very good point, Mary. I mean, I certainly don't think the book is the last word. In some ways, it opens up all these other regions where there's this fascinating case studies of big individuals, these hyper-empowered individuals that I mentioned. And Havel is a classic hyper-empowered individual, you know, playwright, dissident. And then, of course, somebody that, as you acknowledge, goes on to a presidency, and not only goes on to a presidency, but is somebody that's a very acute observer, critic of his own performance and the performance of his own country, and of course his own countries in the sense of the Czech-Slovak division as well. So again, there's lots of other sort of illustrations that I think can be brought out that I don't know all the nuance about, but that other people do, that can kind of put into, fill out some of these wider trends. I mean, the only case, of course, that I did focus on in Eastern Europe was the case of Gorbachev. That's a very different case in many ways. But, of course, in some ways, it's quite similar in the sense that he becomes a critic of the regime, both before him, but of course also after him, and becomes a bit of a non-persona with the Yeltsin government. And mm-hmm. of course this is why in some ways, like Tony Blair, he spends so much time outside of the Russian Federation. He's very unpopular in many cases, even in some cases where he does adverts. You know, he's making money.
Yes,
he's also
right.
You know, he does a Pizza Hut advert. And, you know, and it's quite popular. But, of course, he doesn't have the Pizza Hut advert in Russia because, of course, it wouldn't be popular there. And this particular places with Gorbachev is extremely popular, not only in the United States, where he does a lot of touring, a lot of sort of celebration, but also, of course, Germany, that, of course, is the main beneficiary or a big beneficiary of the collapse of the Soviet Union with the reunification. So once more, Gorbachev is feted in Germany. He does all sorts of adverts. He appears in a Wim Wenders movie. Does all sorts of things, you know, that really puts him into that very special sort of celebrity status.
He is really, when you think about him, what an interesting life this man has had.
Well, the other thing is that they all have interesting spouses,
yes,
you know, wives. And he does. I mean, his wife, who dies early, tragically, but also has a major foundation in Russia. But, of course, you know, not only Hillary Clinton, but, Sherry Blair, you know, all of them either are active, you know, very explicitly out in the forefront or active more behind the scenes.
Right. We have Tim on Facebook who wonders what you think, Andrew, President Obama's political afterlife will look like.
I'm beginning to really think about this because I think it's going to be a real indication of what he sort of thinks about his own political career. I mean, one, of course, is that he's done enough. He spends his time playing golf. You know, he kind of goes back to that earlier sort of image of ex-presidents, of Eisenhower and Jerry Ford and so on, whether he goes international in the same way, and certainly was probably you'd put the most money on that bet, in the sense that this would be very much a continuity with Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, and particularly, of course, if he's seen as a successful foreign policy president in terms of his Cuba initiative, of course, now, today, yesterday, in terms of the Iran deal, and really sort of ratchets up that type of approach that we've already seen from two very prominent former Democrat presidents, or whether he decides he goes back to his kind of roots and goes back to more local issues and sort of focuses on sort of local education, local health issues, and so on. So I think it's still out, it's unclear, but there's a lot of choices and a lot of sort of guides now to options. You know, he certainly doesn't lack, you know, the different sort of trajectories that other people have gone mm-hmm. before him.
The other thing, I think about Carter again and again because of his age. This man is remarkable in how he's taken on these issues and travels the world, and he's well into his 80s.
I think he's 90 now, you know, so...
Is he 90 now?
I think he's just.
Oh, my goodness.
So in that sense, you know, you have a president leaves the presidency in 1980 and has 20, 35 years as a
right.
president, most of them in a fairly active role. I mean, again, going back to your comments before, there was a little sort of pause at the beginning. But also, of course, like most presidents, he was also very active in putting a library, you know, a presidential sort of memory memorialization in Atlanta. So most probably it's always difficult for former leaders, former presidents, to get going right away. They have to kind of have a bit of a pause. And, of course, some of them also want to write memoirs. And most probably this would be the other feature of a post-Obama presidency, that I certainly, given his success in writing, you know, books leading up to his presidency, you certainly think there's going to be a book or two after his presidency.
Yeah. What about George W. Bush? Has he been doing any international...
Very little. You know, and partly most probably this is his own kind of sense of localism. You get the sense that he's very active in sort of Texas, but very little in terms of forays into sort of international speech making. You know, so whether this changes, I mean, sometimes former leaders can have a decade or so where they're not seen as being, you know, sort of go-to people in terms of speeches, and then something changes, or their behavior changes, or they get involved with other activities that rebrand them, and then they become sort of more major figures. So, this is the other sort of, I guess, the implicit theme in the book, is that a lot of leaders now are very young when they leave office.
Yes.
And this is the sort of quote from Tony Blair that I start the book out with, you know, in the sense that, you know, I'm lucky. I've had this life in politics, but now I'm still a young person. I've got lots of other opportunities. You know, who's going to criticize me for taking those opportunities? And I think in that regard, they're very influenced by the high-tech world. I mean, many people that they come across are also, of course, major hyper-empowered individuals who are also very young. You know, the high-tech people tend to be, you know, kind of either under 40 or just over 40. So once more, there's a lot of modeling that people can have this life and kind of go full out. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to wait to be, you know, wizened, you know, sort of veterans and so on. They're ready to go and recreate a different image of themselves.
Andrew Cooper is our guest this hour. His book is Diplomatic Afterlives, and he looks at particularly Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Mikhail Gorbachev, and the work that they've done really on an international stage on a variety of initiatives, how it has been successful work, how it has added to maybe some of the shortcomings of their administrations, but it also has possible potential conflicts of interest, and we're looking at that part of this as well. And we're looking at what it is, and maybe this would be an interesting question for you to take on to the audience. What do you think President Obama will do? What would make him shine after his presidency? What initiatives would it behoove him to spend his, he's going to be a young man, but his presidential retirement, what should he concentrate on? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Andrew Cooper. He is the author of Diplomatic Afterlives, and we'll be welcoming phone calls to 800-486-8655. Professor Cooper, does the success of many of these initiatives indicate that there may be some international bodies that aren't doing their jobs?
Exactly. And I think if there wasn't, it's not only a supply, it's a demand question. And I think it shows that there's a lot of kind of legitimacy, but also kind of efficiency questions. People are kind of searching around for how to deal with issues and problem-solving techniques. And I think this is what really opens up the space for these hyper-empowered individuals. And it's not only former leaders. I mean, it's the Bonos, it's the Angelina Jolies, mm-hmm. it's the George Clooney's, but of course it's also the Bill Gates and the Ted Turners and, you know, George Soros, all sorts of kind of people coming in from the financial world or from the world of high tech. And of course there's real strengths in this. As one of your callers suggested, you know, you have somebody who has a life in Microsoft. They know how to do problems. They know how to deal instrumentally with questions. But a sense is whether there's sort of problems attached to this. You know, that in a sense you have all of these international bodies supposed to be solving health issues, education issues, UNICEF, the relief yes. agencies in terms of refugees and so on. So what's the problem? You know, how do they match up? Why do we give so much attention now to these other types of individuals?
Victor is our next caller in West Dallas. Hi.
Hi. Always enjoy your program. I have a couple comments. One is the Clinton Foundation. When the Haiti situation occurred, Bill Clinton and George Bush raised a huge amount of money. Okay, and it was reported sometime later that it was completely flat busted. And yet nothing has been done whatsoever in Haiti that can be measurable, to that point. And number two, what irritates me the most is where you hear, like, Hillary is asking $265,000 for a one-hour speech, and her daughter, because they couldn't afford her daughter made a $65,000 speech with 10 minutes of talking, 20 minutes of photographing, a couple of question and answers. The question is this: when they put in the foundation, they be skirts a lot of taxes.
Well, back to the original question, I mean, on Haiti, I mean, I still think I would be supportive of the issues in, I think we go back to all the telethons and so on. I mean, you can see sort of the ability of not just Clinton, but President H.W. Bush as well, being able to attract attention. And, I mean, of course, they're not only deliverable organizations. I mean, they don't have the infrastructure. Even the Clinton Global Initiative doesn't have the infrastructure to solve the problems of infrastructure, health, education in Haiti. All they can do, really, is to bring awareness, to raise resources, and then in some ways mobilize other sort of groups. So once more, I'd agree with you that there's a lot of sort of gaps in the, you know, delivery on the ground. And, of course, it's not just a Clinton initiative problem. It's a problem of sort of governance, public policy writ large. On the tax issue, I mean, when you're dealing with such complex issues, presumably they have extremely good tax lawyers in terms of this type of activity. But I think my criticism probably is a little bit more muted, both in terms of because of the work that I see them doing, But also, I think just the psychological attraction of, I guess, they can make money, you know, and they have had careers where they're spending a lot of time with other people who've made a lot of money, doing far less sort of public policy, good governance, you know, publicly minded activities than them. So it's probably, you know, I'm still a supporter of these activities, even though I think you wouldn't want to draw attention to them and draw and be analytical without drawing some of the questions about them as well.
Thank you, Victor. Sandra and Racine, hi.
Oh, hi. I am so impressed with President Carter's initiative and actually hands-on work in eradicating the guinea worm in Africa. That is phenomenal. It's like 99% eradicated.
And again, this is one of the issues. I mean, it's not as high profile, of course, in the first world as HIV/AIDS or some of the other health issues. But we see that the Carter Center locates an issue where they feel that they can do a good job. They mobilize resources. As I mentioned, some of those resources come from the Gates Foundation on that disease, and they also can have credibility with NGOs, with medical workers on the ground to do good work. There's still a lot of problems in this type of environment because, of course, some of the areas where they do good work get immersed in civil war, political turmoil, and so on, and then some of the good work gets dissipated. I mean, the Carter Foundation has had to withdraw from a number of countries at different times in West Africa because mm-hmm. of the political issues. But it's certainly not because the local population feels that they're not doing a good job or that they haven't picked the right topics to deal with.
And who even knew about the guinea worm? I mean, his work, there is an element of, I don't need to be patted on the back. There seems to be an element of, this is where attention must be paid.
And I think this was always the criticism of President Carter when he was in office. He was a great detail person,
you know,
perhaps over-detailed, trying to micromanage every issue all the time. But you can see also the benefits of that type of approach, you know, picking these sort of issues on health, dealing with difficult people in the front lines of diplomatic mediation, whether it's dictators in Ethiopia and Eritrea way back in 1988, whether it's dealing with sort of dictators in Panama, whether it's dealing with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. So again, you got to give him credit for this sort of resilience and this ability to kind of just keep going in terms of you know, you pick your plan, you have a fairly concentrated game plan in some areas and a very flexible game plan in others because you never know where the next mediation sort of issue is going to break out. But there's this firm foundation of certain issues that you keep going through the decade.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sandra, so much for your call. Mamadou in Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm originally from Mali, so I've been witnessing, you know, for the Carter Foundation, and they did a lot of, you know, good work over there. My question would be, like, is this a trend, you know, like with the liberal president working, you know, on the international scene because of their value more than the Republican president? That's my question.
Yeah, I think this is probably, if you were looking at this sociologically, you would say that that's very much the case, that they have a certain sort of sense of liberal internationalism that they want to accentuate. But also, of course, as previous callers have suggested, there's also this support among some groups within the international organization to build their activities within their own framework. I mean, after all, there were rumors that Bill Clinton could even sort of stand as a UN Secretary General mm-hmm. after he left office. You know, Tony Blair was mooted to be a World Bank president. You know, so there's a certain type of leader that they're both American, but they're also, of course, highly valued and treasured even in the international arena. And, of course, this is not always the case in the Republican presidents. And, of course, probably President George W. Bush is the classic example of that. But at the same time, we may see, of course, different patterns in the future. And just like we've seen different patterns in the past, where probably there were Republicans who were highly sort of internationalist, maybe not liberal internationalist, but internationalist. Theodore Roosevelt,
sure,
for instance, you know, was mediating between the Russians and the Japanese back in 1905. So again, some of these trends sort of go in cyclical patterns.
Andrew, thank you very much for being with us. It was really an interesting hour. Thanks.
Kathleen, pleasure to be on. All good luck.
And to you as well. All good luck. I like that. Andrew Cooper, the book is Diplomatic Afterlives, and we thank him so much for being with us. He's professor of political science at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada, and associate senior fellow at the Center for Global Cooperation Research. Thanks to KP Whaley for production of this program. A reminder, tomorrow at this time, we'll be talking about the discovered Harper Lee book that changes our image of Atticus.